Okay, great. I'm happy to shift us into our last couple sessions. I'm happy in a bittersweet way, actually. It's been so great, we don't want it to end. But we have two more great panels ahead of us this afternoon. And we're kind of shifting with both of these panels, pushing the boundaries a bit further of I think, all the categories that have been in play, pushing the boundaries of the educational beyond the classroom in many cases, pushing the boundaries of the industrial in some cases, and science also sort of floating in through these panels. So we're going to start off with the sex ed panel. Loosely put, sex ed. And we start off with another collaborative pair, Christopher Lane and Amy Sloper from UCLA. I'm not sure who's beginning, Chris or Amy? Chris and Amy.
Hi, just to clarify, I'm Amy.
And my name's Christopher Lane. And our panel is Sex Miseducation, the Sex Ed Film in the Moving Image Archive. And, go ahead.
Okay, before we start, we'd like to give a special thanks to Dan Strebel, the Orphans Film Symposium, and the UCLA Graduate School of Education and Information Studies for their financial support in bringing Chris and I out to South Carolina. As well, we'd like to thank Valerie Schwan from the University of Southern California's Moving Image Archive for her assistance with the print we'll be showing this afternoon. So to start, I'd just like to speak a bit on the genesis of the research we'll be presenting this afternoon and how we arrived at this point. The initial interest in this topic arose from the idea that sex ed films presented a false history of sexuality in America. In particular, we were thinking of the films from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, ones that failed to mention any subversion in sexual practice or really sexuality at all, ones that delineated gender roles along very strict lines, ones that spoke only of sex in reproductive terms, and ones that in promoting abstinence only were denying the truth of the times, that teenagers were in fact sexually active. In sum, we expected to see a lot of dry, scientific, overly sanitized films talking about blossoming into a young woman or man, and also a few of those really scary VD films we had heard so much about from our parents. And in our beginning research, that is what we found. The films that were most readily available to us, we saw some on the Educational Archives DVDs put out by the AV Geeks, and also on the Prelinger Archives at archive.org, portrayed exactly what we were expecting to see. Once we started digging into the archives, though, mostly into uncatalogued collections, we were surprised at what we found. We saw many films that contradicted our idea of what a sex ed film is, especially given that we were part of a generation that did not grow up watching these films in the classroom. We saw films that taught three-year-olds about the clitoris and the scrotum, films that talked bluntly and openly about homosexuality and how it was okay to be gay, films that demystified masturbation, and that's only to name a few. While our initial research question had centered only on the problem of dealing with these films in the archive, we soon realized that these films, when viewed historically with others in their genre, existed in a context all their own and were laden in cultural value. Certain ones presented progressive and changing attitudes towards women's bodies, sexual practice, use of birth control, masturbation, homosexuality, and teenage pregnancy. Given the cultural richness of these materials, new questions arose. Why aren't these films being utilized for research? Why are they buried, relatively unknown, in the vaults of these archives? And what can archivists do to change this? There are currently a number of case studies about how whole collections of educational films have found their place on the shelves of archives and libraries. Indeed, as a number of scholars and archivists have established, various institutions took these neglected and unwanted materials with open arms when production companies shut down, when school districts purged their collections to make room for video, and when some libraries decided their shelves should no longer be filled with antiquated products of technology. However, virtually no scholarship exists to defend why these films should remain in archives and libraries, other than their importance to our moving image heritage. Now conserved for long-term retention, their original purpose and intent no longer exists. Educational films today do not instruct students, and adolescents about scientific facts, historical occurrences, and social norms. So then, what is their new purpose? Some archivists maintain the philosophy that to safeguard educational film serves as evidence of one of the many uses of motion picture film. Others contend that their kitsch or camp value is significant in a nostalgic society that appropriates images in new forms of media. We are here to argue that educational films can be utilized for a wide variety of scholarly purposes, in that these materials are bountiful sources for scholars from fields of study not only within film, but also areas of research outside and drastically different from film studies. Specifically, we feel that the sex ed film can be an excellent resource for scholars and researchers in such fields as gender studies, public health, education, medicine, and sexuality, and that the archivist should be more active in promoting the use of these orphan materials in all applicable fields of study, so that these very important historical and cultural documents are not lost in the crevices of collective memory. Now I'm going to turn it over to Chris.
Thank you, Amy. So let's start this off by quickly looking at some of the current perceptions and overall availability of sex ed films. With the death of motion picture film in the classroom sometime in the mid-1980s, the new and emerging generation of archivists and scholars, like Amy and myself, who grew up in this era have rarely experienced an educational film in the context of the classroom. Subsequently, there is little known about this form of motion pictures among many young academics and archivists. The only perception of these films we have is that sex ed films are laden with Victorian morals and portrayals of the body in an antiquated manner. Thus, many emerging scholars and archivists view them as forms of camp and kitsch. While indeed this is quite an important perception of sex ed films, it should not be the only one. A new perception of scholarly value in sex ed films is important because there never before has been recognition of the breadth and depth of the genre, or cluster, as Plunger calls it. While, of course, there are a small selection of books and chapters of books on sex ed films, they do not fully encompass the trajectory of these films or note the trends in the history of their production. Ken Smith's Mental Hygiene, Classroom Films, 1945 to 1970, is an excellent book to introduce anyone to the use of motion picture film in the classroom and to the history of some of the major educational film production companies. However, his analysis of sex ed films is quite slim. Robert Eberwein's book, Sex Ed, Film, Video, and the Framework of Desire, is the beginning of scholarship exclusively dedicated to the realm of sex ed films. However, there are chunks of film production history missing from his analysis, namely the sex ed films from the 1970s. In essence, we found that there is limited scholarship on this genre, and a necessity exists for a thorough investigation of this genre's history so that the trends of sex ed films are recognized and thus utilized for scholarly purposes. Archivists, and not just scholars, should work towards uncovering the breadth and depth of this hidden history of educational films by making these collections accessible to researchers from all disciplines. Some of this has been done, as we briefly mentioned, with the Educational Archives DVDs by AV Geeks and Prelinger Archives. Archivists should not only lead researchers towards those campy and regressive sex ed films, but also they should advocate including silent sex ed films from the 1920s, as well as progressive films from the 1970s that have previously been overlooked in scholarship and research. If archivists do not begin to advocate for the use of these neglected materials, they will be forgotten by a generation that never knew varieties of sex ed films even existed. One of the most interesting films, among a handful, we came across is entitled Linda's Film on Menstruation. It's a part of the Los Angeles Public Library collection at the University of Southern California's Moving Image Archive. Like most library film collections, the LAPL began to incorporate video into its collection in the 1980s, leaving its highly prized film collection on the shelves. It was not until 1999 that the library decided it would be best to purge its vibrant and eclectic collection of educational, scientific, documentary, theatrical, and avant-garde films to make space for new acquisitions, and thus donated the collection to USC's Moving Image Archive. Linda's film on menstruation was directed by Linda Pfefferman in 1974 and produced with the help of grant monies acquired through the American Film Institute, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Creative Artists Public Service Program. It should also be noted that this is not an institutionally affiliated film. So before we screen this film, we'd like to preface that the film is quite faded, as you can see. This is a capture of the title. And as well, the opening titles are largely missing except for three frames of it. And so thanks to digital technologies, we've captured one frame of it so you can actually see it. And as well, we will only be showing half of the film due to time purposes. And also, maybe to view this film in its historical context, if there are any men uncomfortable with the concept of menstruation, you might want to leave. So let's go ahead and roll the film.
Thank you. sperm comes out of the testes and they meet the female body in the fallopian tube.
What, are you trying to confuse me or something?
Now, Lola, look at me. See my head? See my body? They're connected by my neck. See the ovary? See the uterus? They're connected by the fallopian tubes. The fallopian tube is just another passageway in the body.
I get it. Fallopian tube is just another passageway in the body.
Right, except there are two of them, one for each ovary.
Right.
Now, once a month, the pituitary gland notifies egg cells to mature, break out of one of the ovaries, and travel through the fallopian tube to the uterus. If the egg cell gets to the uterus without being fertilized, the lining of blood and tissue there that would house this strong egg cell is not needed. So the egg and the lining disintegrate, flow out of the body through the vagina. That's called menstruation.
Menstruation.
Yes, it is, but it makes a lot of sense.
Does?
Sure. Menstruation comes from the Latin word menses, which means monthly.
Oh, yeah. Why does that make sense?
Because monthly, this lining of blood and tissue builds up to receive the egg that monthly breaks out of the ovary.
You mean that every month a new baby could start growing there?
No, Lola. Usually, when one egg cell is fertilized, the lining won't dissolve, and the body doesn't notify the ovaries to release any more eggs.
I see. There's just one thing I don't understand, Francine. How does the sperm get into the fallopian tube so it can meet the egg?
Well, Lola, that happens as a result of sexual intercourse when no form of contraception is used. Then the woman can become pregnant. Now, by using birth control, every woman can make her own decision when to have children. So unless a woman is pregnant, she should get her period every month.
I don't know, Francie. You're awful smart.
Joanne Johnson was on the street today, continuing her inquest of hygiene in the city. Today's topic, menstruation.
I'm here on the street, stopping people at random, asking them their feelings about a very important yet personal subject.
Yeah, very much aware of when I'm going to get it.
How?
By physical symptoms.
Like what?
Bloating. And I usually, the day before, get rather tense and feel irritable.
I have terrible bellyache.
The night before, I get super hungry and compulsively nervous.
And I was the last one in the crowd to get it, and I was also very underdeveloped and small, so I felt like a child, and I didn't feel like a woman until I got my period.
I got my period about the time most of my friends were, which was 13, and it didn't symbolize anything to me that being a woman. It was just like another thing to cope with. But I generally have terrible cramps, or I had terrible cramps. I found that if I didn't exercise, that this would kind of ease the cramps.
You lie back.
And he raised your legs and just kind of lowered them slowly to the ground.
I flow very heavily, and I can use two tampons at once when one napkin wouldn't be effective at all.
And,
well, you put, they actually fit in side by side, and if you put one in and just hold the string and then insert the other one just gently, it'll fit in beside it. You're really lucky that you can use tampons at this age, because when I was younger, they used to believe that you could only use a tampon if you weren't a virgin. But I think most mothers have that idea, because tampons haven't been around for that long, really.
Well, the trouble with this diagram is that it shows a standing figure. And I think when you're first starting, it's much easier to put one in when you're sitting down. The hardest thing to do is to find where to put it, because the vagina is located in the middle. It's not seen on the surface. So what you have to do is spread the outer skin apart, and maybe even use one of your fingers and feel where the entrance to it is. You take the tampon, insert the first segment of the applicator, you hold on to the rim, and then you push this down, and then you remove the applicator. And you don't have to worry about losing a tampon, because the cervix prevents it from going very far. So you just should be able to find it with your fingers. And sometimes tampons don't come with an applicator. Just put the tampon itself in, maybe even lubricate the tip to make it go in more easily.
Wouldn't you know it, I finally get my brother's car to go to the beach and it starts to rain. Not only that, Judy disappears off to her new home, the bathroom, and I get stuck lugging all this stuff to the shelter. The weather report said warm and sunny.
I wanted to go swimming.
Well, you can't go swimming. You're having your period.